everybody. This is John Marks, the editor of CopsAlive.com, and I want to welcome you to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. I am very pleased to have our guest today. We're going to be talking about training like the United States Navy SEALs. Specifically, we're going to talk about preparing yourself for mental toughness and operational readiness and what you can learn from the SEALs to make you safer in your law enforcement career. I'd like to welcome our guest. My guest today is Commander Eric Potterat of the United States Navy Special Warfare Command. Dr. Potterat is the force psychologist for the U.S. Navy SEALs, and he has developed an awful lot of the training programs we're going to talk about. Dr. Potterat, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I appreciate your time. Can you give us a little bit about your background, specifically in this concept of designing training for the SEALs to prepare them to be mentally tough and what you've told me is considered operationally ready? And we're talking about mental training here, psychological training. Is that true?
Okay, certainly, yes.
Okay.
Let's see. It's probably best to start. I've been in the Navy about 17 years. About the last seven of those years have been with Naval Special Warfare, the SEALs. In 2006, I arrived to the BUDS training, Naval Special Warfare Center, and I was given a charter to help or assist in the development of a formal mental toughness or adversity tolerance training program. So that kind of started started the dominoes rolling, I guess, as it were. And early on, I looked at focusing and taking a lot from the sports psychology literature and really some of the tools and techniques that athletes have used to control their human stress response during performance. It became obvious to me that in working with Naval Special Warfare and SEALs that performance is everything. It's all about how they perform on the battlefield, how they perform in training, et cetera. So, again, to answer your question, yes, developed a paradigm and a training program which focused on initially four things, which I think has permutated a bit to add a few more as well.
Okay. And I think when we talked earlier, originally it sounded to me like you designed this to even help the candidates complete the BUDS training, which is the initial indoctrination training into the SEAL program. And my understanding, the entire program is actually a couple of years long in order to be fully welcomed into the SEALs. But if I'm not mistaken, you were invited to help them more successfully endure some of the mental challenges of just going through BUDS. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, it's difficult to say, how shall I say this? There were multiple programs in play at that time. I think after 9/11, there was a presidential mandate to, you know, increase special operations. Increase the number of special operators. So that was one of many things that Naval Special Warfare Center was doing, and a few of them fell on my lap. Specifically, we developed an instrument that could help predict who probably was a low likelihood of making it through. Yeah. But a secondary program that was developed was of the folks showing up to BUDS, how could we better prepare them to make it through as well?
And my understanding is that it started as just sort of helping them prepare themselves mentally, but even as you've developed this over the last 6 or 7 years, it has grown to even include how to maintain their operational readiness, which is why I was drawn to you, because it seems to me that the same sort of concepts would apply to law enforcement officers, not only teaching them how to prepare themselves to be mentally tough, but also maintaining that toughness to maintain their operational readiness.
I couldn't agree more. I think law enforcement and special operators, I think they're different sides of the same coin. I'll cut to the chase. For me, it became very obvious early on that there's a lot of information out there. There are a lot of opinions out there. There are a lot of studies out there looking at different ways to build resilience. That seems to be a very popular word nowadays, to build mental toughness, to build adversity tolerance, et cetera. And I looked at all of those things, and I concluded that one of the commonalities that exists is really this, the issue of the human stress response. So So for me, I tried to get back to basics. I came to the conclusion that, hey, if we could teach techniques to help individuals, regardless of their law enforcement, SEALs, or school teachers, control the human stress response, then by definition, they should perform better. I think most people would agree that it's stress and specifically what happens physiologically and cognitively during stress that negatively impacts and affects performance. So that was really my personal charter, to be honest with you, for the Navy or for Naval Special Warfare, was to develop a paradigm or a training program that would help individuals better control the human stress response, therefore perform better. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think it ties in really well with what we're trying to do here. The mission at Cops Alive is to try to save the lives of those people that save lives. And one way to do that is to try to prevent, you know, officers from getting killed in the line of duty. That's one direct approach. But what we're seeing is that there's a whole nother factor, and that's the mental or the psychological factor of what it takes to endure a 10, 20, 30-year career. And what we're seeing is that sometimes it's not even the traumatic stresses, but it is the cumulative stresses that erode an officer's ability to, you know, even live happily in their retirement. So I was certainly drawn to what you're doing because it seems to me that it's pretty transferable. And, so what I'm hearing from you is you're training them to prepare themselves mentally in advance, but they're also kind of continuing that process to maintain that edge, if you will.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think truly, in my opinion, the enemy here is stress. I mean, not to sound too cliche,
right,
but I absolutely am a fundamental believer in this cumulative stress issue. I think the episodic or, you know, onesies, twosies dealing with a stressful life event, most of us are prepared to handle that okay. But I think when you're talking about special operator SEALs, law enforcement individuals, people whose job it is to face stressors and extremely stressful situations on a day in, day out basis, I think that, I mean, the long-term effects of that stress response and the cumulative effects, I think, start to bleed into things that we in the military are very concerned with, you know, post-traumatic stress, right, marital issues, you know, I hate to sound too touchy-feely here, but emotional numbness. I think it's, and that was, you know, to go back to these mental toughness or operational readiness or adversity tolerance techniques, the goal is, hey, if we could teach some techniques to help people control that response, given that they're going to face these stressors day in, day out, then by definition, we should have a better impact on those cumulative effects.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate what you're doing. Thank you for what you're doing for our military, and I appreciate your time today to maybe help our cops do the same thing. Can we be more specific? I know that there may be some boundaries on what you can talk about, but can you talk about the kinds of techniques that you're training the SEALs to learn to develop to control their stresses, et cetera?
Absolutely. And if you're comfortable with it, I think I'd rather, first I'd like to back up and kind of talk about the human stress response first to at least give context to what the enemy is, as it were.
So, no problem. Go ahead.
I think when I talk about the human stress response, I think most of us can picture a stressor, you know, or we can picture an everyday acceptable stressor. I'm going to bring one up that may be a bit silly, but hey, let's assume that, you know, we're sitting at our desks or somewhere and a grizzly bear were to walk in. There are certain things that are going to happen neuroanatomically and physiologically. And I want to break it down at least a little bit because it's going to come back to those techniques that you want to talk about here shortly.
Okay.
There's something that we teach. We teach the HPA axis, or the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal cortex axis. So back to the grizzly bear analogy. Grizzly bear walks in. I process that. My hypothalamus talks to my pituitary gland. Pituitary releases some chemicals, some hormones, and then the adrenal cortex starts releasing cortisol and adrenaline. Mm-hmm. Over the short term, there are adaptive reasons why that response, that human stress response, is good. There are certain physiological things that are going to occur. There are certain cognitive things that are going to occur. Physiologically, heart rate increases, blood pressure increases, we have vasoconstriction, muscles, you know, tense up, digestion starts to do a hierarchy of what's important. Cognitively, you know, my memory and concentration might not be as good. I may get confused. I have those higher order executive thinking processes, my ability to abstract and do problem solving may decrease because I'm doing one of three things. I'm fighting, I'm fleeing, or I'm freezing. It's that old fight or flight response. Mm-hmm. And I think as, you know, law enforcement individuals, your primary audience, I think they can relate to this.
Yeah,
so when I say human stress response, that's really ultimately the enemy that we're trying to at least control a little bit better. So, again, the thesis is if I can control and teach techniques to control that human stress response, then performance will improve in any environment at all. Does that make sense?
Yes. And in fact, can I ask you to elaborate just slightly on that? Because my understanding about that response is that it happens whether the bear walks into your office or you imagine the bear walking into your office. And if I'm not mistaken, that's part of the issue, is that the human mind can concoct all these things that trigger that same response, even without having the direct threat there.
Yeah, I think there clearly is some truth to that. You know, for purposes of this discussion, though, I think we all agree that the cumulative side that we want to try to mitigate against.
Right.
So even if some of them are imagined or remembered past experiences or whatnot, and now you're kind of getting into perhaps theoretically PTSD and whatnot. But
right.
The answer is yes. I agree with what you just said.
Okay. Please go on.
So back to the technique. So if that's kind of the fundamental charter for, you know, this is the human stress response, how do we better deal with that? There were certain techniques that, again, that were nicely borrowed from the sports psychology literature. And I want to throw in at the risk of indicting my own profession here, I'm going to be very blunt.
Okay.
I think, as you know, I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm a Navy psychologist. I think psychology in general, again, I'm going to generalize. I'm not going to indict any one individual. I'll indict myself here. I think as psychologists, and I think your law enforcement individuals can relate to this, historically, especially of late, we have not done ourselves very many favors in trying to market the idea of performance enhancement or risk mitigation or readiness very well.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we're trained as psychologists to look for symptoms, identify those symptoms, and then try to mitigate symptoms.
Right.
In other words, we're looking for problems. And, you know, when I apply back to 2006, when I first got involved with the Naval Special Warfare community, it became very clear to me early on that I was going to have to move away from pathology and more towards performance enhancement to really get a hook in getting these guys to understand a different way of looking at stress. You know, I could label stress. We could call it XYZ ABC, and I could open the DSM-4, which is our diagnostic manual, and I could, you know, accurately and clinically come up with some recommendations. But people would probably tune me out or tune whomever out was speaking at that point. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I think that the one community that acted as a nice bridge for looking at between clinical psychology and kind of the operational side was that sports psych or performance enhancement community.
Mm.
So consequently, to come full circle, again, a lot of the techniques that professional high-risk athletes have used for years, because we're able to study things in different ways now with fMRIs and we can look at hormonal research, we can really see a lot of these techniques that people have been using are their physiological effects, meaning are there positive effects, and lo and behold, there are. So back to your question, the four core techniques that we taught in 2006, the first one was goal setting / segmenting. The second was arousal control. The third was visualization. And the fourth was positive self-talk. And then we have since added three more, compartmentalization, contingency planning, and focus / concentration training as well.
And can you elaborate a little bit on what you, even if you're speaking to a law enforcement audience, what does that mean to them? How does this help their stress response?
Yeah, so each one is a little bit different. Obviously, we'll start with goal setting and segmenting. You know, goal setting, I'm going to start with the easiest, right? I mean, we all have goals. But anytime you have the opportunity to think about, and again, I'm going to leave it to you and your audience to creatively think about the application of this within law enforcement.
Sure.
Law enforcement is not my expertise.
Okay.
But when we're talking about training, you know, Naval Special Warfare, BUD students, or SEALs, the whole idea that we want to start training early is this idea of segmenting larger goals into very manageable, controllable pieces. Rather than becoming overwhelmed with whatever the task is at hand, it's easy for all of us to be assigned a task or an operation or perhaps something in law enforcement, you know, some sort of operational plan that has to take place, and get one can find themselves overwhelmed by that. So what we teach is early on the mindset of breaking that up into manageable pieces or segmenting that larger goal into smaller ones. The second technique is arousal control, a bit of a funny term. But it really is teaching a certain breathing technique that research has beautifully shown helps mitigate and almost normalize that human stress response. All those physiological and cognitive reactions that I talked about early on, there's a breathing technique that we call the theory of fours. It's taking a deep kind of diaphragmatic breath, filling your lungs, you know, 25% at a time. A deep breath 4 seconds in, 4 seconds out for roughly 4 to 6 minutes. And research has shown that it actually activates an area of the brain that mimics stage three sleep. I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but it mimics a stage in sleep that you and I and your audience all go through every night that causes some semblance of homeostasis, and it causes profound relaxation during that stage. So in a way, we're teaching a breathing technique to help almost trick the brain into thinking it's in that stage of sleep, and it reverses all those physiological stress responses that I talked about, the vasoconstriction, increased heart rate, all of that. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the fastest non-medication ways to mitigate or reduce the human stress response is that breathing technique.
Okay.
The third technique is visualization. This one is sometimes difficult it can be difficult to wrap your head around when we don't have a fixed or known operation or stimulus that you're going into. The fundamental tenets behind visualization is stress inoculation.
Right.
If we teach individuals to visualize what they're about to likely face, and we ask them to do that by utilizing as many senses as possible, then the first time they actually face that operation or that task in reality is the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth time their mind has actually faced it. I'll give you a sporting example. My daughter is a swimmer, so I like to bring up swimming as an example. It's a great example because swimmers have a known fixed task that they do. They, you know, they get off the blocks and they'll swim whatever the distance and they swim back. So visualization would be teaching guys and gals to use their senses before that task and feel the water, smell the chlorine, hear the crowd, taste the chlorine, as many senses as possible, with the idea that you're inoculating your mind to what it's about to face. Now you can, you know, make some steps ahead and figure out how maybe your law enforcement personnel who are listening could possibly do that with tasks at hand. You know, are they on certain beats where they're, you know, likely going to face domestic violence, or are they motor cops, or are they, you know, I don't mean to speak out of turn here, but how one applies the visualization is less important than actually doing it.
Yeah, I think
it is a fantastic way to mitigate against the human stress response. Again, the thesis here is stress inoculation.
Okay.
It is giving the mind a little bit of what it's likely going to see so that the next time it sees it in reality, it reacts. Its reactions are much, much smaller and you know, less stress-induced than otherwise. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think a lot of police agencies train their officers to play the what-if game, you know, all the time. You're driving down the street. What if somebody runs a light? What if somebody starts shooting at you? You're going to a call. What if there's somebody comes out of the doorway with a gun? I think most officers automatically play that what-if game all the time, trying to anticipate threats. And so I think they can all identify with that. One question I would have for you, and maybe we can save it for the end, is that this is one area where I kind of wonder, when do we turn it off? Because we're obviously tuned into the concept of hypervigilance, and that is always being on alert. And maybe you can talk at the end about how do you, you know, back down some of this. That might go back to the breathing technique as well, I think.
Yeah, I definitely have some thoughts that we that I can share at the end.
Okay.
So what you're talking about also bleeds into a little bit of contingency planning that we teach as well, but I'll get to that shortly.
Okay.
So the fourth technique is positive self-talk. And again, at the risk of sounding too touchy-feely, really the fundamental idea behind this is we try to teach our students and our SEALs early on and then reinforce it frequently throughout their careers that there's very little control that people have over events. Whether the events, for example, the events that have taken place, where people have almost all of the control is what they tell themselves about that event. So we break it out into what we teach as an ABC model. A stands for activating event, B stands for belief, C stands for consequences. And it was nicely taken from the work of Albert Ellis, who's a rational, emotive, famous therapist who developed a theory and a model for belief systems and whatnot.
Yep.
So again, without getting too in the weeds, for the purposes of this discussion, the fundamental focus is teaching our operators and or your law enforcement individuals that, look, that we can't control what has happened as an event, but we can control what we're telling ourselves about that event.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do, moreover, is we ask individuals to almost start focusing on their belief system, almost like glasses by which they view the world. That belief system is going to dictate how they respond to any actions or any events that take place. They can dwell on the negative, and that's putting their energy where it has zero control. Almost all the consequences, or the C part of that equation, are due to irrational belief systems. So we try to teach them to be extremely positive and move on from situations and talk their way through that. Does that make sense?
Yes, very much so.
It's a very, to me, honestly, of the seven techniques, this is the most important, but honestly, there could be semesters of coursework taught to this one. I mean,
right.
That's, we're getting into a deep dive where, you know, there's a reason people have belief systems developmentally, key mentors in their life, key experiences, all of those key mentors and key experiences ever since they were age five on kind of chisel away at that belief system and almost help dictate how they're going to view things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always throw in the Shakespeare quote, you know, the Hamlet quote, there's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. This is a great example of that. You know, if we can get our operators to believe that, no pun intended, they're going to be in a good situation because it's, you know, neither good nor bad. It's what you're telling yourself about that situation that's going to dictate whether you have positive consequences or negative consequences.
Right.
The fifth technique is compartmentalization. It really, you know, for lack of a better term, understanding, it really is just finding that black box. There are going to be things that law enforcement sees. There are certainly things that our SEALs see by the nature of what they do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes, you know, it should and is difficult to see. There's a time and place to deal with that, and it's not on the battlefield. It's not during the operation. Our guys are taught early on to be extremely mission-focused, as I'm sure law enforcement is as well.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see some things or a buddy next to you falls, et cetera, you kind of need to find that black box. You put it away, you finish the mission, and then you address it at a later time. So we try to teach and enforce that the value of compartmentalizing those things and not letting them derail whatever the mission is.
Okay, that makes sense.
The sixth technique is contingency planning, which I think you are hinting strongly at with regard to teaching as many what-ifs as possible. I think this is very important as far as, you know, playing into the whole stress inoculation as well. This is somewhat controversial in the literature, at least in the sports psych literature as well. There are coaches and managers and sports psychologists that believe that we do not want to teach athletes or anyone that there could be things that go wrong. We will want them to focus on one thing. You get from point A to point B, whether you're a swimmer or whatnot. I again, respect my colleagues, but could not disagree more when it comes to operations or warfare or perhaps even law enforcement as well. I think the more they can think about plan A, B, C, D, E, and F, the less likely they are going to be surprised and the less likely they are going to have that human stress response that we talked about start, you know, dictating performance.
I think when you and I talked earlier, it's not only about, you know, thinking about multiple options of what might happen, but I think you said earlier that it's also about having sort of multiple backup plans so that in your mind, it's not only how you would deal with it, but how you would react to it as well. Was that right?
I agree. Okay. Absolutely agree.
Okay.
And then the last technique is focus and concentration. I mean, I think early on, and it may seem silly to even be talking about, but early on, I think we wanted in 2006, and I'm sure we do now, take students and operators and get them to, you know, practice focus and techniques for focus and concentration as much as possible.
Yeah.
To try to limit distraction, to stay on point, stay on task. So those seven really, combine, and some people like certain ones more than others, and that's okay. But
right.
We found that these seven are a nice package to, again, combating that human stress response, or at least giving tools to our operators to deal with that human stress response.
Excellent. Before I change thoughts, do you have any example of what you do to train them to maintain focus and concentration? Is that something you can share? Is there some little tidbit of something that you can
I prefer not to go into that necessarily. Now we're talking about, tactics and some of that as well. So
I will concoct something. We'll find something for cops and we'll plan something for that. Can we get back to this concept of hypervigilance? How do you, maybe it's the compartmentalization process as well, but how do you turn it off when you go home?
Yeah, so I often, and again, I apologize to you and your audience. I'm sometimes the king of cheesy metaphors here. I really like the metaphor of a dimmer switch, as a light switch. Rather than off and on, I think, there are naive individuals that believe, I can turn it on and I can turn it off, much like an on-off switch. I frankly, with all due respect to those individuals, I have a hard time believing that. I think it's important to educate our operators and law enforcement individuals as well, that this takes time. And I think it's that dimmer switch. I don't think it happens overnight. And I think you can increase or decrease the hypervigilance. You can increase your integration to your reintegration to family and whatnot with routines. One of my biggest fears as a psychologist, to be honest with you, is that cumulative effect of stress and how it impacts the person.
Right.
Because I think, I won't indict SEALs or law enforcement in general. I'll just say I think over time it can come, because of the nature of what Naval Special Warfare operators can do and what law enforcement individuals can do and can see, child abuse, domestic violence, really the darker underbelly of society on a day-in, day-out basis.
Yep.
I think it's normal and natural to assume that over time you can tend to lose faith in humanity. One could easily lose faith in humanity and become almost jaded or callous or cynical, emotionally numb, to use, a bit of a touchy-feely term here. So I think it's important for first people to realize that, and secondly to really understand that what they do and who they are two different things. And I was going to say this till the end, but I think it's something that I definitely try to bring to the SEAL community as frequently as I can, that, being a SEAL is fantastic. That's what you do. Being a law enforcement individual, that's what you do. But be very, very careful when those start to mesh together and you become what you do. I think the healthiest people I know are the ones that can kind of compartmentalize and tease those things away from each other. They're very good at what they do, but they understand that it's a role. They're a police officer. They're a SEAL. They're also a father. They're also a mother. They're also a son. They're a husband. They're a wife, et cetera, et cetera. It's very, very important to understand and pay, equal dividends to all of those roles. And I think that's the balance piece that sometimes is difficult for folks in probably both communities to tease out.
Yeah. One thought that I had is you've had 6 or 7 years now to work with this material, and I would assume you do some sort of research and tracking. Is there anything that you can share with us to say that you found this to be very effective? You've watched it over a period of time. I know initially some of the research I saw really did show an increase in success in getting through the BUDS program. Is there anything you can share with us about that?
Yeah, I need to be careful, not for personal reasons, but just to, again, educate you and the audience a little bit here, that there are many, many initiatives taking place to mitigate, you know, both to increase at the time the throughput for seals, but to also, you know, increase resilience among our operators. So it's very, very difficult to look at causal relationships, you know, that doing these things caused this to happen. I will say that I think you are accurate. I think the BUDS rates have gotten better. Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that our and I think there's research to support as well, that our resilience in the community is strong. You know, our PTSD rates, et cetera. I mean, this is a very good community that focuses a lot of attention on, you know, controlling the human stress response and reintegrating off of the battlefield that operational mindset, reintegrating and keeping balance in life. So,
yeah. One of the reasons I was I'm talking to you is that I know that cops are suspicious by nature. And you've said it yourself, some people don't react well. I use the term the woo-woo. Some people don't react well to the woo-woo. Now, I think you've articulated all of these techniques in a very tangible way, and I think by the very nature of the fact that the United States Navy SEALs, which are arguably one of the most well-trained and competent military forces in the world, if it's good enough for them, it should be good enough for us. And but I'm conscious of the fact there's still some people sitting out there thinking, yeah, but I don't know if I can do that, or yeah, I don't know if that would really work for me. And I think what I just like from you, and I think you've said it a couple times actually, is just some validation that, you know, we wouldn't be doing this if it didn't work, and you guys really ought to try it because it can work for you too.
I absolutely believe it works. And moreover, I think that one of the easiest sells, again, I'll say this because it's very, very important, as a psychologist or as a provider, as a subject matter expert, one can easily come in and pathologize and say, hey, we need to get rid of anxiety, we need to get rid of post-traumatic stress, we need to do this. If law enforcement personnel are anything like the SEALs, there's going to be pushback. Right. The easiest way to get people believing this is, hey, there are known relatively easy techniques that one can do to improve performance. And I think I've yet to meet someone in this community in the military, and I'm sure it's the same for law enforcement, who can't relate to performing, right? They want to perform at their best.
Absolutely.
For the person next to them, for themselves, for society, et cetera. So I will say that these techniques are not, I mean, it's not astrophysics here. I mean, I think we're okay. They're very manageable, very doable. I'll also say this, that it's very important, I think, to have, and I'm going to sound somewhat biased here, but for law enforcement as well, it's important to have trusted, I think, credible, embedded providers. This has paid enormous dividends in the military, especially within special operations, to get the right people who get it into the right positions so that people feel like when they want to move forward and discuss whatever's going on, that they're, you know, not going to be immediately shelved, have weapons taken away or whatnot. This is very, very important to attacking stigma, because I think what you talked about is hinting at the fact that, hey, there's generally some pushback because of stigma and, hey, this is psychobabble. How is this going to apply to me?
Right.
And I think that's very, very important.
Well, and I think you just sort of led into my next comment or question as well, and that is, in our training, we talk about, you know, first you train the individual, in your case, the individual operator, and you give them techniques and tools to make them the best and most capable at their job. But then you also have to provide them with a support system. And that is, you know, that probably taking on cumulative stress is something that's very hard to prevent, but it is something we can mitigate. And you don't necessarily do that all by yourself. You have to have a support mechanism where once you've compartmentalized and you're out of danger and things are quiet again and it's an appropriate time, then you can actually process some of that stuff. And I can only imagine, I mean, sort of preaching to the choir here, but you are the psychologist. You are the person that they can come to, and I would assume you have a whole staff that is there to support them. And law enforcement is a little slow in the uptake on that. We have some large agencies that have staff psychologists, but most agencies across the country have, you know, employee assistance programs or psychologists that are available through their, you know, their medical benefits. I'm trying to stress the fact that, you know, can't do all this by yourself, and I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
I agree. You know, I don't want to indict the EAP programs, the employment assistance programs. I'm sure they're very, very good. I can't speak from experience. I will tell you that what we do here works. I mean, our psychologists, we have them embedded with Naval Special Warfare all over the globe. Yeah. And I think they get out and they'll do physical training. They'll do PT with the guys. They'll shoot with the guys. And they're around. And you know, they become approachable. They're human. They're not seen as these docs in a box who are only looking for problems. And I think that that helped this community and continues to help this community, I think, nicely, positively affect and decrease stigma. And really that's the umbrella that sometimes gets people from, or the barrier that will keep people from, you know, stepping forward to deal with whatever. So I will say also in relation to this comment that in an ideal world, you know, if I could have a magic wand or see 5 or 6 years from now, ideally you want the operators, whether it's Naval Special Warfare or whether it's law enforcement, you want them to self-assess.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, these techniques are great, but ideally this comes down to human factors, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certain human factors. There are what's going on in my life, with my marriage, with my kids, with my finances, my stress levels, my mood, substance use. You know, there are various human factors that we have. And if we get people to buy into this idea, is there a way where I can self-assess and then mitigate based on some sort of feedback I'm getting, then I think we're in good shape. We don't need psychologists to be doing that. So in an ideal world, I think, you know, there's going to be some ideal buy-in for this notion of self-assessment as well.
One last thought I have for you, you know, I think it's probably no different in law enforcement and the military. Most of our people come from a background where they've learned to train themselves physically to be at peak performance. And I'm certain that's true for the SEALs. I'm kind of curious how you get them to recognize that this is just the same and perhaps just as important to train and tune yourself psychologically as it is physically. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So, John, I could probably speak for a week on this. Okay. So we had some very, very good, early on when I was at the Naval Special Warfare Center at BUDS, where they make and create SEALs. We had a good relationship with the Olympic Training Center, just law of proximity. It's one of the Olympic Training Centers is here in Chula Vista. So mm-hmm. we had a close relationship with their psychologists and whatnot. One of the best things that I heard that really stuck with me and honestly impacted the way I view performance was one of the fantastic Olympic psychologists said, you know, the difference between no medal and a gold medal is all between the ears. Mm-hmm. And the more I thought about it when I was looking at the BUDS candidates who are showing up my first year at BUDS, we have incredibly gifted physical specimens who show up. But when you use a statistical term, there's very little variance, meaning these are elite athletes who want to become, you know, special operators. They're physically extremely elite athletes. So there's very tight variance, but yet not everyone was making it through. So it plays, I think, very nicely to what you're saying and to what the Olympic psychologist was saying as well. Everything from the neck down is really that hardware. That hardware is great. If you use a computer analogy, a computer metaphor here, you can have the best computer hardware on the planet, but it's the software that's going to really start to exercise the power of that computer. So it's the neck up. It's the software piece that is really, in my opinion, I don't want to teeter out of, I'm not a SEAL, I'm not going to pretend to be a SEAL, but in my opinion, it's the mental side that is helping these guys make it through. It's same as the athletes, right? The difference between no medal and a gold medal is mental.
Yeah.
You can watch the 100-meter dash. Everyone's within, hundredths of a second of one another. So it's physically, everyone shows up relatively the same at the world-class level.
Well, that was amazing. Thank you. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you want to share with the audience? Anything, any other last thoughts that you had?
No, I don't think so. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the time.
I want to thank you for an outstanding interview. I think there's an awful lot of stuff here that anyone can take and apply to their own personal training regime, and any agency could build it into their own training programs as well. So I appreciate you and the United States Navy and sharing this information with us. And I thank you for being a guest here.
Thank you. And thank the law enforcement individuals for doing what they do every day. Tough job.
Thank you. And please stay safe and wish all the best to the people that you train with. Thank you, everyone, for listening. This has been John Marks. This is another edition of the Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. I want to thank you and encourage you to tune in next time. Stay safe.